Let me take that in two parts, Francis, because there really are, I think, two dimensions to what you're asking me. The first has to do with threats. We have always talked in the language of threats, and during the days of the Cold War, it was easy and convenient to do that because there obviously was one big threat. And so an awful lot of what we did in defense was oriented around the Soviet Union. Today, it's a little bit more subtle and a little bit more complex than talking about threats. The reality at the bottom line here is, which are the challenges, I like to call them, that we have to deal with, and which do we choose to deal with? Because at the bottom line is, where you put your forces and how you use them and the times that you decide to use them are all going to be a matter of choice. If you look, for example, at Iraq and Afghanistan, you could say, and some did at the time, that in 2001 there were a variety of options that we could use to respond to the attack on the World Trade Center. We chose to hook up with the Northern Alliance and bomb Afghanistan, throw the government out, and send forces in. Iraq, even more patently obvious, we chose to go to war. It was not dealing with a threat. In the post-Cold War world, we're really dealing with challenges. What are the priorities, and what is the role of military force? And that's all about choices more than it is about threats. The other issue that you raised is, you know, what about the lessons of past drawdowns? You know, I love this one because Secretary Gates likes to say, you know, every time we've ended some kind of a conflict, we've built down too far, then we've been surprised and discovered we had to build back up, and I don't want to be stuck in that problem again. Well, I think the Secretary needs a new historian, because the last time we were actually surprised by a war was in 1950 when the North Koreans invaded South Korea. Every subsequent conflict that we have entered into with military force has been a matter of choice. We entered into Vietnam choosing to go there and building up. We went into the buildup of the Reagan administration because we chose to go there on spending. We went into Gulf War I because we chose to liberate Kuwait. We went into the Balkans because we chose to put American forces in the Balkans. And the force that we had left behind in the build-down after the end of the Cold War was exactly the force that we chose to go into Iraq with and basically used Saddam Hussein as a speed bump. So the lesson of history is not we build down too far and then have to recover. We have built down, to be sure, after every war, but we have had forces quite capable of the choices we had imposed on them since the Korean War of 1950.
Am I understanding then that you believe that we couldn't potentially be surprised in the future? Are we in? Has the nature of war evolved to a point where we can no longer be surprised?
Well, I'll tell you what the reality here is that the United States has today, because we have spent an unprecedented amount of money on our military forces, right now more money than at any time in constant dollars since the end of the Second World War, we have the world's most dominant military capability. We have the only force that has global intelligence, logistics, communications, transportation. We have the only force that can steam all of the world's seas. We have the only force that can deploy air power globally. We have the only force that can deploy ground forces anywhere in the world. The reality is it's an awesomely dominant military capability, one that almost any other country is reasonably nervous about, because it is so far ahead of what any other country in the world can do. There's no other country that can walk through the litany I just did of how dominant the American military capability is.
I don't think anybody would argue with that. I also wonder how long, at the rate that it seems that China is proficient at stealing our intellectual property, and that's a whole other issue that we can discuss later, I wonder how long we could potentially maintain that supremacy.
For a very long time. Even Secretary Gates likes to point out that we have 11 carriers and no other country has more than one. One of those is British. It's smaller, about half the size of ours. One of them is French. It's smaller, about half the size of ours. And one of them is actually Chinese, but it hasn't sailed yet because they bought it from Ukraine, had to tow it without power to China, and then spent a long time trying to figure out how to outfit it with adequate power to make it actually sail. So it's not sailing yet. And by almost any index that you measure, our military capability is dominant over the Chinese. We actually spend on military research and development alone more money than we estimate the Chinese spend on their entire military budget, all forces, all spigots. So the reality is China is a very, very long way from reaching anything like the global force capability that the United States has, probably many decades.
All right, it's kind of another thought that you included with this, the first myth, that defense spending dictated by the threats we face. You also talk about, as an example of parochial interest, the decision to close GIFCOM in Norfolk, $240 million to operate that each year. Senator Webb was very upset at the beginning. Congressman Forbes very upset at the beginning. That displeasure seems to have dissipated in the meantime when folks learned that a lot of the operations, about half of the operations that will that go on at GIFCOM will continue. And the actual number of jobs lost for, as you allude to, parochial interest, will not actually happen. Why did that stand out in particular to you?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because in reality, we like to say that the defense budget is driven by threats. But the reality is it's actually driven by three things. The world situation, threats, challenges, if you will, opportunities, that's one set. A second thing is bureaucracy. That is to say, which service wants which programs and which activities and which location and which system for its core missions, and by, surprise, surprise, politics. You mentioned Senator Webb. You know, Senator Webb was reacting as any well-paid and well-heeled politician would, saying, not in my district. I'm all for discipline in the defense budget, but when it comes to, you know, Newport News or Joint Forces Command or the shipyards or the hardware program made in my district, well, now that may be essential for national security. It sure as heck is essential for my district and my future in politics. So all of these things, I don't want to sound too cynical, but there's a fair room for cynicism here. Politics plays a big role in what goes into the defense budget.
Gordon Adams is a Distinguished Fellow for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense at the Stimson Center and a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University. He's my guest on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, talking about his five myths of defense spending, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. This week, my special guest will be Steve Abramowitz, director of Accelerant. The show is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, located on the web at ofplaw.com. For more information on the firm, call us at 703-218-2100.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Join host Jane Norris for Fed Central on Wednesday, March 2nd at 11:30 a.m. as she talks with her guests Mitchell Glassman, Director Deloitte Consulting, and the Honorable Tom Davis, former representative from the state of Virginia, now Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. They will discuss how the Dodd-Frank legislation is intended to help restore responsibility and accountability. Don't miss Deloitte's Fed Central program on Wednesday, March 2nd at 11:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m.
Hi, I'm Neil Asbury, host of The Neil Asbury Show. Please join me and my guests each week as we discuss the importance of international trade, entrepreneurialism, small business ownership, job creation, and the American dream.
The Neil Asbury Show, Saturday mornings at 8 on Federal News Radio. The Neil Asbury Show is sponsored by AIT Worldwide Logistics, Yoakum Shore and Trossaven, and WTS, Withers Worldwide Transportation Systems.
What's the buzz in the federal community? Chris Dorbeck knows it. Join Chris for the Dorbeck Insider, weekday afternoons 3 to 7 on Federal News Radio AM. Chris has the insights on who's coming and who's going, new memos, new contracts, fun and helpful ways for federal managers to improve agency productivity while meeting mission goals. The Dorbeck Insider, building federal community by connecting people. Weekday afternoons on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Pentagon Solutions, the first and third Tuesday of every month in the 1 o'clock hour. And my guest today is Gordon Adams of the Stimson Center, also a professor at American University and an experienced hand when it comes to budgeting at the Pentagon and for a national defense. Gordon is one of the authors of a piece called Five Myths About Defense Spending, about which we're speaking specifically today, and also author of a recent piece, which I enjoyed, Gordon, in Foreign Policy Magazine, titled Winning the Battle, Losing the War. We'll have that linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today as well. The second myth that we're on, first one, defense spending dictated by the threats we face. We talked about that a few minutes ago. The second one's, the larger the Pentagon's budget, the safer we are. I imagine that means you think there's too much focus on the top line that the Defense Department gets in the budget.
Yeah, that's part of it. Or if you want to stay with the top line, you could actually say that the variations in defense spending that we have seen historically have always been around situations of war. They haven't been really about situations of anticipated fear. You know, Korea, there was a spike. Vietnam, there was a spike. Maybe the Reagan administration spike constitutes saying we got to build up just in case. But the current spike is obviously around Iraq and Afghanistan. But we have also been extremely safe in the bottom of the curve. That is to say, after Korea, we built down, and Eisenhower adopted a strategy of what he called massive retaliation. It seemed to preserve the security of the Americans pretty well at much lower levels of spending. After Vietnam, we had a huge argument in the U.S. about whether we were safe or not safe vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, but the looking backwards on the intelligence says we were pretty safe. The Soviets were not 10 feet tall. We built up in the Reagan administration. We built down in the 1990s, and the country was, in fact, extraordinarily safe with a lower level of spending. The level of spending is not really what it's all about. It is how well are you spending and what are you spending it for. We can build down and be secure, as we have been over the last 15 or 20 years. We can build up and, to some degree, be a little bit less secure. That is to say, part of the conclusion that one can draw from Iraq and Afghanistan is we invaded countries throughout the regime, occupied them, and to some degree created the very opposition that we then needed to throw more forces on top of the pile to fight.
You make that argument in this piece, which I find interesting, and that portends to issue number two, myth number two on your list: the larger the Pentagon's budget, the safer we are. Number three is that Republicans like defense spending and Democrats don't. Now, that's a pretty time-worn political campaign, old saw, but you make some observations in this that kind of shatter that.
Yeah, it's really interesting historically. If you look back, every defense build down that we have done since the end of the Korean War has been done under a Republican president. Really fascinating. Eisenhower, who had the five stars on his shoulder that nobody at the Pentagon could challenge, led a much restructured, much reduced level of defense spending in the 1950s, and it was kind of hard to argue with him. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, the build down that was carried out then was carried out under the leadership of Richard Milhouse Nixon, and Gerry Ford to some degree, though he wasn't there long, and the stewardship of Mel Laird, Republican Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon. What's really fascinating to me is that at the end of the Cold War, when the Berlin Wall went down and the defense budget went down by 50% between actually 1985 before the end of the Cold War and 1998, and we took in that, you know, post-Cold War period, 700,000 people out of the forces. We took 300,000 civilians out of Pentagon positions at the Department of Defense. All of that was initiated and most of it executed by George Herbert Walker Bush and that, you know, sort of namby-pamby, weak, lily-livered Secretary of Defense he had, a guy named Dick Cheney, whose guts nobody would question. Cheney led this major build down. In fact, Colin Powell referred to it back in January on State of the Union on television. He said, you can manage a build down. Look what we did. And he talked about the 500,000 they took out of the forces and the 25% cut in the defense budget were executed not under Democrats, but under Republicans. So there's a massive myth here that I think is fed by the political rhetoric around Vietnam, which many Democrats opposed, that Democrats have been soft about defense and Republicans have been tough about defense, the historical record just doesn't show it's true.
You cite some of the new Republican leadership in the House as potentially saying that we're not going to take defense off the table. Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the chairman of the Budget Committee, Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. Is it, though, the issue of whether leaders like that get behind cuts overall, or is it a matter of digging into each of the programs, systems, pay and benefits, which we'll talk about next, and so on, or is it a combination of both?
It's kind of a combination of both, but you know what's true today and was equally true in the mid-1980s is that the internal politics of defense, the services that need more and the secretary who wants more, are confronting a couple of external tidal waves. One of them is deficit reduction, and the other is the end of the war in Iraq and the coming end of the war in Afghanistan. These are what I call externalities. They're things that happen outside the stovepipe of people who think just about defense. They hit defense in 1985. They hit it again when the Cold War ended in 1989. And we have the same convergence today of major concern about federal spending and the federal deficit and the debt, and major recognition that we are about to exit two wars and probably don't need to maintain the same level of defense spending that we were maintaining during those wars. So, if you will, the external economics require everything to be on the table. The politics require everything to be on the table to make a deal. And the things that normally hold up levels of defense spending are going away.
That conversation with my guest Gordon Adams revolves around his third myth of five about defense spending. Republicans like defense spending, Democrats don't. Gordon Adams, for 5 years, was the Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs at the Office of Management and Budget. He's my guest for Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back for more conversation in getting to myth number four and myth number five with Gordon Adams in just a few moments.
I'm Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio. Stocks are lower. The Dow's down 86 points. The NASDAQ lower by 28. The Institute for Supply Management survey shows the U.S. manufacturing sector grew in February at its fastest rate since May of 2004. The employment index in the survey rose to its highest level since 1973. The Commerce Department says builders began work on fewer homes, shopping centers, and other types of construction projects in January. Construction spending fell to its lowest level in 5 months. Shareholders of J.Crew have given the thumbs up to a $3 billion deal to take the preppy clothing seller private. And it's been a tough year, couple of years for auto dealers, but the showrooms are busy again. General Motors leading February sales with a 49% jump over the previous year. Chrysler reporting a 13% gain, while Ford reported a 10% sales increase. Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio.
If you're thinking of investing your hard-earned money in the stock market, I have one word of advice for you. Stop! An eye-opening free report by the author of the best-selling book, Bank on Yourself, reveals the truth about how Wall Street has brainwashed Americans into believing you must risk your money in order to grow it. Wall Street lost over 45% of your money twice in the last decade, and they're about to do it again. Hundreds of thousands of Americans use Bank on Yourself. Not one of them lost a single penny in their plans when the market crashed. In fact, their plans will all continue to grow safely and predictably every single year, even when the market crashes again. Learn the secrets to growing your wealth without risking it in the Wall Street casino. All the details are revealed in a free report. For a limited time, you can get this report free at bankonyourself.com. That's bankonyourself.com. Bankonyourself.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Arink.
The Pentagon has moved some of its forces in the region near Libya into position, but won't say for what. Defense Department spokesman Colonel Dave LePan said planners are working on several options and contingency plans as the violence aimed at overthrowing the government continues. As a part of the planning, the Pentagon is repositioning some naval and air forces. The U.S. has a regular military presence in the Mediterranean Sea. I'm J.J. Green.
There's a saying that lightning never strikes the same place twice. Airport operators know that's not the case.
which is why they rely on ARINC to provide the most advanced lightning warning systems available. It allows personnel to get to safety, then back out on the tarmac in the shortest amount of time to keep you moving. For more information and career opportunities, log on to ARINC.com.
Do you know someone who has done something outstanding in the field of human capital management? Nominate them for Federal News Radio's second annual Causey Awards. Together, we'll call attention to what may be a best practice in government. Anyone can be nominated, career, political, and contractors working in the HR field. The award is named after Mike Causey and his lifelong dedication to the reporting of management and federal pay and benefits issues. To nominate someone for the Causey Awards, go to federalnewsradio.com, search award.
FLIR Systems has a singular focus on providing thermal imaging night vision systems for search and rescue, surveillance, and force protection across the globe. We proudly support the men and women who serve, defend, and protect by providing leading-edge technology to enhance mission success. Today, customers trust in FLIR Systems' thermal imaging products and rely on our responsive support worldwide. Visit FLIR.com/GS for more details. FLIR Systems, extraordinary vision for extraordinary heroes.
Hi, I'm Denise Ballou of the FBI. The case was revealed in December 1995. Operation Senior Sentinel targeted illegal boiler rooms and telemarketing fraud.
The case was hugely significant in that it's one of the few, if not only, instances I can think of where an entire crime problem was basically wiped out by very focused, dramatic investigation.
Keith Slaughter is special agent in charge of FBI San Diego. Formerly in Miami, he initiated the undercover operation that evolved into Senior Sentinel.
These were telemarketers who were really, really bad individuals who were promising big prizes and a lot of different things, preying on customers, especially the elderly.
Many were conned into losing their life savings, but the tables were turned.
Instead of using undercover agents in those cases, we used a combination of retired agents and retired citizens affiliated with the AARP to pose as victims.
Ultimately, about 1,200 arrests and hundreds of convictions. I'm Denise Ballou of the Bureau on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The administration has established a new information sharing environment office to discover, protect, fuse, and reuse data across five core communities: intelligence, defense, foreign affairs, law enforcement, and homeland security. Shmendra Paul has been tasked as ISE lead to increase government-wide data sharing efficiencies through the use of standards and information technology. Join FCA Bethesda, Paul, and ISE partners for a discussion on the topic March 16th at the Bethesda North Marriott. To register, visit fciabethesda.com/marbreakfast.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Jim Washington is the Chief Acquisition Officer at the Federal Aviation Administration, or at least he was until recently. He retired not too long ago, and he'll be my guest in hour number two of the program, starting at about a half hour from now, to talk about his thoughts about building a better acquisition workforce, keeping the talent your agency already has, to minimize the need to bring in new people, and a lot more issues having to do with how your agency gets the stuff that it needs to keep operating. Jim Washington, my guest in the second hour of In Depth with Francis Rose today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hour number one is focused on Pentagon Solutions with Gordon Adams, Distinguished Fellow for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense at the Stimson Center, also a professor at American University and the former Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs at OMB. Gordon, we're talking about your recent piece in the Washington Post entitled Five Myths About Defense Spending. And myth number four is today's levels of military pay and benefits are necessary. I'm sure you understand the political difficulties of trying to tell the defense community and potentially your constituents on military bases that you think they make enough money already.
Yeah, this is probably the toughest third rail of military budgeting. It's interesting, we're kind of a long ways away here from where we started, which is defense spending is dictated by the threats we face. There is no question that workforce management, if you will, the management of military personnel and of civilian personnel, I might add, the Department of Defense is one of the toughest issues that we have to deal with in dealing with the defense budget and dealing with particularly the politics and the bureaucratics of defense budgeting. I got my bathtub experience on this particular issue was when I was at OMB giving a lecture out at the Naval Postgraduate School out in Monterey, California, with 1,500 people in the audience rising as we entered for the commandant, not for me. And then listening to a talk about budgets and national security and the succeeding 45 minutes of Q&A were all questions about pay and benefits. And there's no question, everybody who works for the federal government or works in the private sector, you know, when the rubber hits the road, it's about where you park your car, where you have your office, and what your pay and benefits are. That's how we all have to live. It's a difficult problem in the defense case. There has been a long effort put in over 20 or 30 years now to bring general wages and comparability for the military labor force to a position where they are competitive and comparable to wages in the private sector. According to a study put out in the last month by the Congressional Budget Office, by one of their defense personnel experts, we're in a pretty good shape on that score. The wages are highly comparable. The benefits are probably superlative, as anybody taking federal benefits or military benefits knows. But it is now causing us fiscal issues, and there's a couple of issues buried in here. One is compensation, where wages now tend to be comparable to those in the private sector. But we are paying everybody across the board in the military a pay increase when we raise wages, rather than targeting and managing the force to get and retain the skill sets that we want in the force of the future. So one of the things that we talk about is managing that wage and compensation issue by using more special pays and retention bonuses in order to have the labor force you need, rather than providing across the board pay increases for everybody. The other big issue, it's really two other big issues, health and retirement. Healthcare, as the Secretary of Defense says, is sort of eating the defense budget alive. We have a health benefits architecture, which, like most health policies, is extraordinarily expensive. But in this case, as a benefit, retirees who are eligible for, not yet eligible for Medicare, pay relatively little compared to the rest of the country for their enrollment fees for the military TRICARE system, about $460 a year rather than the roughly average of $5,000 a year for people in the private sector. And so one of the things that we have suggested is that needs to be looked at, and the Secretary has asked for a small increase in that enrollment fee over something slightly over $500 a year in his current budget request. We support that, probably could go further. And the other is retirement. Boy, this is a huge issue because military retirement is one heck of a benefit, I got to say. It doesn't always serve force management purposes well. And what I mean by that is cliff vesting, as they call it, waiting until you're 20 in to retire, means from 5 years to 20 years, you don't vest any pension. You get no benefits whatsoever. What that means is you stay until you're 20. Okay, what that means is for the services, that's a force management issue. There may be people that you want to gently persuade that it's time to look for other employment because it's a bill that you need to fill with a more qualified person or a different skill set or what have you. Can't do that because you've got people waiting until they're 20. So it makes force management hard. And then the really tough third rail issue, which is drawing full pension after 20. Almost nobody in the private sector has that deal. It's a very, very good deal. So we have suggested, as the Quadrennial Review of Military Compensation has suggested, that it's time to move towards a system where military retirees draw their pensions at the same point in time that civilian retirees do, which is around the age of 57 or so. And you have a one-time transitional payment when you leave military service in order to help you transition into the private sector and into alternative employment. But these are tough. These are really tough, Francis. They come at you from all directions when you go into these issues. I used to have to brief them when I was at OMB, and I've certainly got the spear point marks in my chest for having had to do so.
Periodically, I talk to Greg Long, the head of the Thrift Savings Plan, and other officials at the TSP, and they always mention their frustration at being able to bring members of the military into the TSP. They're big fans of their plan, and they should be. Private sector financial planners are jealous of the Thrift Savings Plan because of how cheap it is, how well administered it is, and so on and so forth. Is there a connection, do you think, or is it maybe worth looking at the connection to the low level of participation in the Thrift Savings Plan to what you were talking about retirees being able to pull their full pension at 20 years?
Oh, there's no question there's a connection here. Why would you want to participate in that plan when you've got such a tremendous benefit here as a military retiree? If you went in that direction, and I actually have a TSP account as a former federal employee, You know, you go in that direction on the military side, it's one of the ways that you could structure this system so that you're kind of a FERS model, if you will. This is what the Quadrennial Review of Military Compensation looked at, is a kind of a FERS model, which allowed people to contribute into something like the TSP or the TSP itself, you know, from while they're active, having the sort of cafeteria approach to benefits that's different from the TRICARE system. But I have to tell you, it's such a terrific benefit. You know, I don't know, and I know lots of military retirees, and boy, you get to this subject, and it's like, well, now, wait a minute. You know, this is a heck of a good benefit. And it's very hard to have a reasonable, rational discussion downstream about how we need to restructure this so that we're not eating up our defense capability on wages, salaries, benefits, and health care.
All right, one more thought about this, and that is I kind of alluded to the idea of members of Congress having to go home and defend to the rank and file on the bases that are in their districts and states that you're not worth a pay increase. We want to hold the line there. Secretary Gates, when he first started to talk about this reform last spring, it's almost a year ago now, in May, was talking about the what he called top-heavy force structure, where there were lots of flag officers and so forth. Is there enough there that he could substantially reduce his pay and benefits costs by restructuring that, or is this a more broad restructuring effort that's going to be needed here?
I think it has to be a more broad restructuring effort. He's talking about, you know, finding a way to bring out something like 10% of the flag officers across the military. And that's a very good thing, but I rather suspect your savings from that is not going to get you very far towards getting these things under control. I mean, there's really two things that will affect this on the pay and benefit side. You know, one is purely the size of the force, and we've made some proposals about size of force in the piece that you're referring to and in our article in Foreign Affairs, the January-February issue. Size of force is going to drive down the cost of military personnel. And the other is altering the level and vector of some of these benefits programs. You grandfather the people who are in them now because you have to, and that's right, you should. That's the commitment that they have. But you start working with your new entries. You don't get that fiscal discipline right away because you're working with new entry people for the most part. But, you know, you'd be surprised how much of a difference it makes 10 or 15 years out in what you're going to have to spend in the military budget.
Gordon Adams is my guest on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're talking about his five myths about defense spending. He is a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University. And we'll continue our conversation with myth number five when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal friends, it's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the Government Employees Insurance Company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Do you know someone who has done something outstanding in the field of human capital management? Nominate them for Federal News Radio's second annual Causey Awards. Together, we'll call attention to what may be a best practice in government. Anyone can be nominated, career, political, and contractors working in the HR field. The award is named after Mike Causey and his lifelong dedication to the reporting of management and federal pay and benefits issues. To nominate someone for the Causey Awards, go to federalnewsradio.com, search award.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Tony Scardino, a chief financial officer at the Patent and Trademark Office.
CRs are debilitating.
they're starting to go longer and longer. Problem is, once you actually get an appropriation, usually you get a budget increase or you get a budget decrease. How are you going to manage that over the next X amount of months to get you to the end of the fiscal year? Well, that's really challenging. Think of your procurement staff, all the contracts you have to continually reaward for shorter periods.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Pentagon Solutions is the first and third Tuesday of every month. We talk to an expert in the world of the Pentagon about the issues that the agency's dealing with and how to find real solutions for them. And my guest today is Gordon Adams, Distinguished Fellow for Budgeting at Foreign Affairs and Defense at the Stimson Center and former Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs at the Office of Management and Budget. The five myths about defense spending are the subject of our conversation, Gordon. And myth number five is that Secretary Gates's cuts, the cuts that he's proposed so far, are enough. Step in the right direction, or not even headed the right way, do you think?
Well, they're a step in the right direction. I call what Secretary Gates has done so far trench warfare. It kind of reminds me of World War I. Actually, it reminds me of what every Secretary of Defense has tried to do since time immemorial, and that is year by year by year, they retreat one trench at a time during a build down. Now, we've had this, as I've said before, after Korea, after Vietnam, at the end of the Cold War, and now this is the fourth build down episode that we've had since Korea. And, you know, we've kind of got the hang of it. We kind of know how to manage it. But every Secretary of Defense starts by saying, this far and no further, I've drawn a line in the sand, we can't go any further. And the next year that line has moved a little bit, and the next year that line has moved a little bit. And each time the Secretary is being forced a trench backwards in his defense of his budget. And you wouldn't expect a Cabinet Secretary to do anything other, so I'm not surprised. What we're going to find, I predict, in about 5 years is we're going to go back and look at what the Secretary of Defense thought was going to be the defense budget starting 2 years ago or even starting this coming year, fiscal 12, and looking at the line on the graph that it was supposed to be and then the line on the graph of what it was, and we will realize we've had ourselves one heck of a build-down over that period of time. So the Secretary, you know, from my point of view, he's not doing enough. From his point of view, he's doing what he has to do. But he hasn't really acknowledged the fact yet that the budget is going down. The $78 billion that he talks about is a reduction from the anticipated growth he thought he would have over the next 5 years. It doesn't really take the defense budget down. In his books, that budget would still grow in fiscal 12. It would still grow in fiscal 13. It would still grow in fiscal 14. And it would be level with inflation growth. It would still grow, but just with inflation in 15 and 16, which are frankly years he won't have anything to do about anyway because he'll be well gone by then. So those years are kind of fictional. In the near term, he wants that budget to keep growing, and that's, you know, that's his position, and by golly, he's gonna plant his stake right in that position. We're saying that outside of defense, outside the world that the Secretary lives in, the deficit and the end of the wars are collapsing on the defense budget, and it is going down. We're in a classical, we've been there before, kind of build-down situation. And it's my judgment, at least, that the Department of Defense and the services and the defense industry, all the people in this business, had better start doing the kind of serious thinking now about how you manage a build-down. It is manageable. You have to think about how you're going to do it.
You alluded to something which was where I was going to go next. You're making my job real easy, Gordon, and I appreciate that. You mentioned Secretary Gates is not long for his job. There's been some discussion about when he would leave. It's kind of become a party game in D.C. How long will he last? He said himself he wants to leave within a year or so. And I guess finding someone with his vision and finding someone with the force to continue that vision could present itself as a pretty formidable challenge for President Obama.
I think President Obama has, to some degree, been really lucky with Bob Gates as Secretary of Defense, because in many respects, he's a terrific Secretary of Defense. From where I sit in my perch, I think he needs to go further than he's been going. But he's doing the job he thinks he should do, and because he comes from the background he does, and because he's served under a Republican president as well, he does provide the president with some political cover here. The downside of that is that they're not really visionary about this question of a build-down and how you manage it. This is mostly trench warfare, so the administration finds itself in the odd position of defending high levels of defense spending when their own Democrats and an increasing number of Republican voices are saying this has to play its part in the whole process of deficit reduction and debt control in the United States. Give us some options here. So part of what we have been doing in our writing, and we've done the article in Foreign Affairs, and we've done a big open meeting on Friday, the 25th of February, that was with the Bipartisan Policy Center, is okay. Let's get past this stage of saying should we have a build down. Let's just say, are we having a build down? Yes. Okay. If we are, what should we be doing to manage it properly?
I want to ask you to play along with this parlor game, and I'll give you a chance to think about it through the break. Not a specific name. I'm not going to put you that much on the spot. But maybe the background or portfolio or areas of expertise of the person that would be able to do that, that would be able to take on that role as you just described it, when Secretary Gates departs. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Gordon Adams. He's a distinguished fellow for budgeting for foreign affairs and defense at the Stimson Center, former associate director for national security and international affairs at OMB, and a professor at American University. My guest on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Now, the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Unions hoping to represent Transportation Security Administration workers now have a tentative date for an election. The Federal Labor Relations Authority has picked March 9th for when employees can begin balloting. The final hang-up is for unions to clarify their self-descriptions. The American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Employees Union are in contention to represent 40,000 TSA workers. I'm Amy Morris.
The beginning of another year is one of the best times to review the state of your financial affairs. Unfortunately, many individuals overlook one of the most important aspects of their financial plan, life insurance. For example, if the worst should happen, are your spouse and children fully protected? Please take a moment to consider WAEPA at waepa.org. WAEPA is a nonprofit association founded in 1943 by federal employees for federal employees. Once again, that's waepa.org.
Anoop Ghosh from Avincia Alliance commented during the panel discussion, Advanced Persistent Threat, Industrial Strength Hacking, brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
From a technology point of view, we know we're not going to fix the user, and we're not going to create perfect software. So what can we do? Well, we can design resilient architectures, said in a different way, which is separate the untrusted code and separate user actions from the security of that system.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com. Keyword, Booz Allen. Whether it's the theft of intellectual property, state secrets, or the disruption of critical systems that power our economy and ensure our national security, Booz Allen Hamilton's strategy and technology consultants provide an integrated cybersecurity approach across the full spectrum of people, process, and technology to leverage and provide a way of thinking and action to address advanced persistent threats across government and industry. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Join host Jane Norris for Fed Central on Wednesday, March 2nd at 11:30 a.m. as she talks with her guests Mitchell Glassman, Director Deloitte Consulting, and the Honorable Tom Davis, former representative from the state of Virginia, now Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. They will discuss how the Dodd-Frank legislation is intended to help restore responsibility and accountability. Don't miss Deloitte's Fed Central program on Wednesday, March 2nd at 11:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Last April, 256 senior federal managers went missing. Are you next? The most successful managers know to never pass up an opportunity to learn. Join them this year to discover how to maximize your agency's forward momentum at the Federal Senior Management Conference at the Hyatt Regency Chesapeake Bay in Cambridge, Maryland, this April 10th through 13th. The Federal Senior Management Conference is the preeminent conference for senior federal managers, presented for government by government advisors, with registration open only to government employees. Register now at fedsmc.com or call 202-237-0300.
$300.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest for Pentagon Solutions in hour number one of the program today is Gordon Adams, Distinguished Fellow for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense at the Stimson Center, and a prolific author about issues surrounding Pentagon budgeting and spending. And we were talking in the break about the imminent departure, Gordon, of Defense Secretary Robert Gates. What do you think, at least background experience or credential-wise, not necessarily a name, but based on those issues, what do you think the next SecDef should look like? Who what kind of person should take that job?
This is always a hard question to answer because, you know, the reality is in past build-downs, we've had all kinds of secretaries of defense who've done it well. Of course, you know, Eisenhower was his own secretary of defense and he did it very well, but he knew exactly what buttons to push and where the hidden problems were. You had a guy like Mel Laird under Richard Nixon. Now, Laird's knowledge in defense was probably an inch deep, and if it was a mile wide, I'd be surprised. But Laird had tremendous political skill. He could make you just love the fact that you were cutting his budget. He was incredible in the Pentagon. Then you completely switched types with Dick Cheney, who was, you know, Mr. Hard as Nails, who was decisive and tough and made decisions that brought people out of the military force. And he had the user-friendly Colin Powell working with him in undertaking that exercise. And in the 90s, he had Bill Perry, whom everybody loved because he's just a wonderful human being and very, very knowledgeable in defense. So you've got, you know, what kind of personality and what kind of knowledge. I think the next president's, the next secretary of the president's going to need somebody who has a pretty decent vision or a sense of the right priorities of missions for the forces. I like pieces of what Secretary Gates had to say, but he's not going to be that guy. He'll be gone, I think, this year. So somebody who has a sense of future missions and not going to let that be driven by the services. I think you're going to need somebody who is decisive. One of the hidden secrets about Don Rumsfeld was that while he jumped up and down and stormed about and made a lot of noise, he wasn't very decisive. He didn't like to make decisions. He didn't like to push people one direction or another. And you got to combine that ability to be visionary and decisive with being user-friendly to the services. It ought to be somebody who, you know, the services reasonably respect, they're going to listen to, that they think has reasonably good judgment, doesn't need to be an ex-military person, doesn't even need to be necessarily a defense expert. There are people actually serving in this administration who could fit, you know, that combination of skills. But I think that's what they're going to have to look for.
Not to make this a one-on-one you versus the person I'm going to name, but if we step back and look at this 2 years from now, realistically, given all of the challenges that you've talked about, who do you think is going to have won, do you think we can say, the Gordon Adamses of the world or the Buck McKeons of the world?
Oh, I think the Buck McKeons are now on the losing side of history. There's no question in my mind that we're headed for a build-down. And the Buck McKeons are not even going to be as adept as the Secretary of Defense is in conducting trench warfare. The realists are the people who are going to win. I'm thinking about somebody, you know, even though he'll probably be gone by then, like Admiral Mullen. But, you know, Admiral Mullen said the most remarkable thing in early January. He said the budget has basically doubled in the last decade. And my own experience here is that in doubling, we've lost our ability to prioritize, to make hard decisions, to do tough analysis, to make trades. And I think the people who see the problem clearly, the way Admiral Mullen has described that problem right there, are the people who are going to win, because we are in a build-down, and it does need to be managed. The Buck McKeons aren't going to be on board with that management. They're going to be playing catch-up ball.
Gordon Adams, a pleasure to have you on the program today. I appreciate your time, and I can't believe it's already up, but thank you for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Francis. Appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Pentagon Solutions with my guest, Gordon Adams, Distinguished Fellow for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense at the Stimson Center, professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, and former Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs at the Office of Management and Budget. The pieces that we talked about, authored by Gordon in Foreign Policy Magazine and the Washington Post, will be posted later on today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number two of the program right around the corner. Acquisition in focus in hour two, and I'll introduce you to our guest in just minutes on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.